Good evening. I'd like to welcome you all here and thank you for coming this evening. Our speaker tonight is Laura Waterman Woodstock from the Seneca Nation, the Huron Clan. She was the editor of the Legislative Review from August in 71 to July of 73. She's the director of Project Media, National Indian Education Association, from September in 1973 until April in 1975. She was the executive director of the American Indian Press Association from April until October, and she continues as an associate. She also works with the Red Schoolhouse, the Native American Survival School in St. Paul. I'd like to introduce you to Laura Woodstock.
Thank you. Good evening. I hope I don't put you all to sleep tonight. I just finished a 9-day week in Washington, D.C. with the American Indian Policy Review Commission. I don't know how many of you know about it, and I thought I might spend a few minutes talking about it later on in my talk. What I'm going to be talking about mainly is American Indian journalism. And I think I can tell you now that there is good news and bad news. Indian journalists are being trained in greater numbers. They're much more proficient at their craft. We have upwards of 60 newspapers that have proven their viability by being in operation over 5 years, who are producing either weekly or monthly publications. But the bad news is, with the economic situation being what it is, many of the newspapers have had to fold. Many of the people who have been trained as journalists are finding that they must work in other areas, albeit they do try to stay within Indian organizations. And unfortunately, among the casualties has been the American Indian Press Association, with whom I'd been associated for the last 5 years. Although the association has suspended its news service until more funding can be found, the board of directors, who are themselves editors of periodicals, have decided that they wanted to try to keep the association open until such time as we could raise the funds. I think one of the important things to remember when we talk about Indian journalism, because it seems to be a concept that is not readily connectable with the Native American cultures, that the idea of gathering the news and spreading the news has its roots in tribal life. There were persons within clans, as I come from the Iroquois, and there were persons within the Plains tribes whose job it was to go through the village or go through the camp and say whatever the news was. In many of the songs that have come from the Plains Indians now, you can often hear the crier at the beginning of the song riding through the camp, giving out the news of that particular day or moment. Expeditions, particularly the war expeditions of the Kiowa tribe, were heralded at the inception as the chiefs went around to recruit his men. And when they returned, either victorious or defeated, and told the stories of what happened on their campaign. I think that we can say that Indian journalism today does not resemble very closely this type of news gathering and spreading. What has been the very difficult task, and perhaps the most difficult task for Indian journalists, is to maintain and cultivate an objectivity in the face of news in which we most certainly feel a compassion, a brotherhood, a feeling that we want to get in the fight ourselves. At the same time, we had to maintain some distance in order to be able to see the story in its correct perspective. This particular point has brought about many criticisms of the Indian Press Association, particularly in an occupation situation where we would send perhaps one reporter. It was extremely difficult the BIA occupation of 1972. I was the reporter in the building for 7 days, and the Wounded Knee occupation, Richard LaCourse spent about 3 days there. The AIM Treaty Conference in Mobridge, South Dakota, 1974, Tom Richards was there. The thing that we felt the worst about, I guess if you can put it in those terms, is that we couldn't spend more time. We just didn't have the resources, we didn't have the cameras, we didn't have the right tape equipment, and we really felt sort of pitiful compared to ABC and CBS, who were coming in with all their expensive stuff. But the one thing we could do was to try to report the story in the best way that was available to us, based on the facts that we could gather and based on the judgments that we could make about a situation that was developing very rapidly. And those elements were present both in the BIA building occupation and in the Wounded Knee. And I'd like to talk about both of those separately, because I think those two news events would be interesting to you. And I'd like to give you a little more idea about how we ultimately decided to handle the situation. In the BIA occupation, which began on the 7th of November in 1972, we had received quite a bit of prior notice. The American Indian Movement had set up a communication center, and they were advising us daily of the caravan, the Trail of Broken Treaties caravan, as it made its progress from Washington State, Northern California, intersecting in Minneapolis-St. Paul, and then traveling on to Washington, D.C. They encountered many logistical problems. There were several breakdowns in the vehicles. They weren't always greeted with open arms by the communities they passed through. They suffered from a lack of funds. And those of us that were in Washington as individual people did what we could in the way of trying to find homes and one thing or another, trying to maintain that balance, as I mentioned before, between objective reporting to protect the truthfulness, I suppose, or the balance of the story, and our feelings as individuals supportive of what was happening as a historical and important movement to Indian people overall. Well, they came into Washington, and the first thing that happened was there were some church facilities that had been provided for them. However, there was a large rat colony in one of the church basements, and it was a little more than they could handle, so they were once again out on the street. That Thursday afternoon, they went to the Bureau of Indian Affairs auditorium and decided to hold a meeting. In the meantime, the executive department of the government has a police force. These are the people that protect the White House, direct the traffic around the federal agencies, and generally take care of the Capitol grounds and so on. These are sort of special officers. They had all been alerted and were together in the, I believe it was the agriculture building, several blocks down Constitution Avenue. There was also word that the tactical squad had been called, but that they had not grouped into formation yet. So the meeting was continuing on with a dialogue between the leaders of the caravan, and they were Hank Adams, Robert Burnett, who had been the chairman of the Rosebud Tribe and who is now once again chairman, Russell Means, Dennis Banks, Clyde Belcourt, Vernon Belcourt, Ted Means, Sid Mills from Washington, and a number of other people, including two medicine men, Henry Crow Dog, and another man who called himself a Day Eagle, I believe, was his name, from Sioux City. So as the conversation was going on, it became apparent that something was going to happen. And I was alone. There was not another reporter with me, so I had to very quickly make a decision on whether, if the building were secured, whether I was going to go outside or inside. So I finally decided that I'd better go outside in order to make communication with the office. And in just those few minutes, the tactical squad decided to descend on the BIA, forcing AIM into a decision to secure the building. So with all of the very young people, young children and old people on the inside, they found themselves in a situation where they had to barricade all the doors and begin a sort of paramilitary action without very much preparation. There was a scuffle, there was one injury, which was documented by George Ortez, who is an Indian person who is a commercial photographer. And the events were set in motion for the next several days. It seemed to us, at that particular point, the National Congress of American Indians was holding their conference in Seattle, Washington, and Richard LaCourse, our news director, was out there covering that story. We were virtually 3,000 miles apart. Fortunately, John Tiger, who was then associate with the NCAI and was on loan to the Press Association, was available, and so the two of us returned to the building, not knowing whether we would have to stay for the entire duration or whether we would be allowed to go in and out, depending on what the security situation was. Fortunately, one of us was allowed to come out while the other stayed in, and so we were able to get a better reading of the events as they happened. Knowing many of the people, perhaps on a first-name basis, the tribal chairman people as well as the AIM people, was sometimes an advantage and sometimes a disadvantage. It was a disadvantage in that they would not open up in front of us, so we couldn't overhear anything. We would sort of have to try to blend into the background, but if we were spotted, they immediately would clam up and we couldn't really get anything. Another disadvantage is that whenever there were negotiations, we were not allowed to be a part of them until well into the fifth day, so that there was no actual recording of any of these events, and we had to rely on the accounts of the people as they came out of the room. So a good deal of our time was spent sitting in hallways, standing in the basement, and just sort of milling around, trying to get any news, and then when we did get some news, trying to check it out and trying to find a phone that was working. By the second day, there were no phones in the building except in the commissioner's office, and that was had been taken over as the headquarters of the negotiating team. So much of the time, it was simply out of the question to try to get news out or try to confirm movements of government people from the inside. So we finally decided that it would be impossible to report the story as it happened. It would be very likely that some of the things that we had to say would be proven untrue later on. So rather than do that, we decided to get together. At that time, I was the editor of the Legislative Review, which was a monthly magazine on Indian legislation. We decided to recount the facts in a special 72-page issue of the magazine, which we did. We included a center section of perhaps 20 or 30 photographs. All of the court proceedings were included, a history of the BIA and its treatment of Indian programs that had been legislated. A chronology of events as we knew them to happen, and the outcome in terms of the interagency task force that was created to attempt to address itself to some of the problems raised by the 20 points that were brought by the caravan to Washington, D.C. I think we all know from the news that there were mixed feelings about the outcome of the Bureau occupation. Some people felt that because OEO funds provided $66,000 for the rank and file people who were there to return to their homes, that they were co-opted, that they had sold out. Our observation of the general need of the people was that we didn't particularly feel that it was a sellout situation. On the other hand, many people felt that the tribal chairmen were overreacting to the situation because they did come out with telegrams and public statements condemning the action out of hand. And what we found was that while they were making these statements publicly, privately they were telling people that they supported them because they were their brothers. And it was a highly emotional situation and very, very difficult to plumb the depths of. But that's the way we handled that particular story. In the Wounded Knee occupation, it was immediately decided when we heard that, first of all, we got word that something was imminent on the 26th of February. On the 27th, the occupation commenced. And about 2 days later, we got Richard out to the scene. The situation was somewhat different in Wounded Knee in that it was an extremely isolated area, and it had been secured by a general perimeter established by the occupants. Many of the news people that came in had to walk 10 to 15 miles over rough terrain to get in. And what Richard found when he got there was that many of the press people were reacting extremely emotionally to the scene. There was a broad spectrum of reactions from supporting and almost becoming a PR arm for the occupants to an excessive reactionary position, thinking they were communists. And there was an AP photographer there who actually did take pictures and hand them over to the FBI. And this, of course, is beyond violation of the whatever ethical code that we may have as journalists, not to interfere with the news event as it's taking place. The dynamism of the situation was very volatile. Tempers were high, feelings were high. It was very difficult to maintain control of the people who were inside by the handful of leadership persons that were there. And very often, 20 to 30 people would be expelled from the occupation area and then allowed to return at some later time because there was suspicion was running high of allegiance. And once again, the situation appeared to be one in which there was not a great deal of preparation. In other words, we did not feel that this was a conspiracy type of thing that had taken months of planning and had been calculated. It rather seemed to be a more or less quickly developing situation in which the leadership was trying to make plans as they went along. And in our opinion, it was quite difficult for them to negotiate from that posture. I'm afraid that our reporting on Wounded Knee was not all that good. We've talked it over many, many times. The main reason we feel, of course, was the lack of money. We got Richard out there. We couldn't keep him there. We had practically no resources. We had no photographers. And once again, we were faced and put in competition with a glut of money-heavy ABC reporters who had very fat wallets, and CBS reporters, and even BBC, even some of the Japanese newspapers had better coverage than the American Indian Press Association. And I suppose it's a part of human frailty, but in many situations when press conferences were called, both in the BIA and during Wounded Knee, Indian Press was not particularly given a front seat, simply because we could not provide electronic media coverage. So once again, we found ourselves in an extremely difficult situation. What did make a big difference at Wounded Knee was that the president of our association at the time, in, I'm sure, a moment of compassion and goodwill, issued a public statement saying that the Press Association supported Wounded Knee. And we all knew as individuals that, of course, we did. But it had blown apart our day-to-day working statement that we would be objective in all news coverage. And I'd like to go into more of the reasons why, but it forced us into a situation where our executive director at the time, Rose Robinson, had to come out with another statement to all the editors of the papers who pay for our news stories. We misspoke ourselves kind of statement that even though their support is there as individuals, that as a press association, we were bound to give our best shot in terms of objective coverage. And one of the reasons that, well, maybe I can illustrate it this way. If we come out with a statement such as happened at Wounded Knee saying we're in favor of the occupation, the door was practically closed on us. In fact, it was closed on us by the tribal chairman. They didn't trust us in the first place, being, you know, rather suspicious anyway. But by doing that, we were unable to get the news story as we wanted to get it. So, is that, do you understand what I'm trying to say? Okay. So there's a couple of the rough spots that I can recall in covering news and in Indian affairs. As I said in the beginning of my talk, we have good news and bad news. I think that Akwesasne Notes, for its point of view, and Wasaha, for its point of view, are two of the finest newspapers we have. They are the two national papers, and they come out monthly, Akwesasne, 10 months a year, because they have a planting season. They're quite different in their format, and they're quite different in their editorial policies, and I think that that's good. I think that one enhances the other and one balances the other. There are a number of small magazines, particularly prison magazines, oddly enough, that are very creative. They carry AIPA news service stories. They seem to be very interested in what's happening around the country in Indian affairs. And they seem to take a lot of trouble to have a nice looking magazine. Many of our young people who are coming out of journalism schools are certainly well-equipped technically. They have a feel for Indian affairs. The first thing they want to do is to get to Washington so they can get to understand the federal system and the Congress. And it seems so ironic to us who 5 years ago were stamping our feet and making speeches around the country saying we need more Indian journalists, we don't need engineers, we don't need nuclear scientists, we need journalists. And now that we have them, we're having a very hard time getting them good jobs and doing the things that they've been trained to do. But we still have hope that something is just around the corner. AIPA has operated as a nonprofit organization. We're thinking of perhaps even going commercial. That because the integrity that we've been able to build up over these last 5 years seems to be a saleable or marketable item, we may just try to go into business. I don't know. Let's see, what time do we have? Is there anybody that would like to ask some questions about anything I've been talking about? Yes.
You said it's AIPA that functions as a nonprofit organization?
Yes, we have.
How do you find yourselves then? Since you don't sell commercials or something?
Yeah, it's a very weird situation. We're a membership organization because we want the control of the press organization to be in Indian hands. The members are Indian publications, and they pay like $40 a year. But of course, $40 a year times 60 publications is not going to run a press service. We also sell subscriptions for $100 a year, and anybody can subscribe from Time Magazine on to, you know, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Time, unfortunately, does not subscribe. Where we've run into problems is that whenever there is a news event involving American Indians, we get calls from Newsweek, Time, the New York Times, the Washington Post saying, how old is Russell Means? Where did he come from? Where did he go to school? We provide that information free of charge. And one of the things that we could do for ourselves in becoming commercial is to sell that as a news service, because it does seem to be the one thing that's in demand all the time. And the other members of the working press just sort of take it for granted that we'll spend hours and hours with them explaining all of these things to them, or looking up laws or one thing and another. We've been glad to provide it, and we continue to provide it because we want people to know more, and we want reporters to be more informed when they write their stories. As a incidental focus of the Indian Press Association, we're trying to educate other journalists to stop using cliches like Indians on warpath again, such words as militant when they can't think of anything else to say, and some of the other ancient things that have been around since probably the Indian Wars of the last century when they were coined. Yes, I think that was put out by the United Native Americans. Lehman Brightman was the president of that association. I haven't heard from them lately. I hope they're just on the back burner and not completely out of business.
We've been hearing things about one thing in particular is history books that have tended to stereotype Indians in their telling of what happened and how we got to where we are. Is the Indian Press Association fighting against these things, or have they had a part in these things, or is that?
Well, of course, we're more interested in developing events that happen today. And I think the way in which we can contribute to that is by the best reportage that we can come up with. And we actually feel a responsibility beyond perhaps what we would feel if we were working for the Washington Post, because we are Indians. And so we want to get it right and make sure it is right, because we do have a feeling for many, many people using the articles. And so that's perhaps our contribution in that area. Yeah, Debbie.
What was that second
paper
you mentioned?
It's published out of San Francisco by the American Indian Historical Society. Take time out here. Akwesasne Notes is not an objective newspaper. It does not profess to be. It is a paper of the people and by the people. And they publish various articles, but they always try to have tribal names correctly spelled, tribal references in their most natural setting. And a great deal of, they spend a couple of pages on letters, so there's a great deal of interchange of information, and usually one or two pages of poetry. By contrast, Wasaha has a great number of what I would call strictly news articles. Many of the articles that express an opinion, however, are not bylined, which is something I don't really agree with. whenever the Indian Press Association put out a special story and there was something in it which either led people to a conclusion or seemed to contain the opinion of the writer, we always bylined it so that our readers would know who wrote it. And we're even thinking of adding names of everybody who contributed to every article. Unfortunately, WASAHA does not do this, and I'm not entirely in favor of that, but I would say that on balance, they are a fairly good newspaper because they get out a variety of news.
As an advisor to the Red Schoolhouse Board, do you get involved with textbooks or any books that are used for that school so that you have some time spent in scanning books and finding what is historically accurate?
Well, the Project Media that we mentioned earlier is an acronym for Media Evaluation and Dissemination by Indian Americans. It's a program that was begun at the National Indian Education Association, funded under Title IV of the Indian Education Act. And I was quite fortunate in being the implementer, I suppose, of the project. Its focus was...
Yeah.
...by, for, or about Indians, and especially including textbooks and curriculum materials. The indexing of the book was to be done by a computer, which we did, and we wound up with over 19,000 titles. Some of those were duplicates or second editions or paperback editions, and we were going through a refining process so that we probably would wind up with about 14,000 volumes. We then developed a list of 560 potential evaluators from 180 different tribes. And the plan was to match up the book or the movie or the tape concerning that tribe with a person who would evaluate it from the same tribe. As I understand it, that system is now in operation. Of course, it's going to take some years to get every single thing evaluated. Some of the things are not in English. We tried to confine it to English, but some of the earlier reprinted books are in French. A good deal of the music are in the Indian languages themselves. And there is some crossover, especially in textbook treatments of Indian, where they're discussing four or five tribes at a time, and you can't really tell which one they're talking about particularly, and those present special problems and need to go to evaluators who are themselves historians or educators of some kind. At Red Schoolhouse, it has been the finding of the director, the school board, and the parents that there simply was not enough textbook material available to present as curriculum for the children if they were going to follow a philosophy of culturally and spiritually based education. So basically what they're doing is developing their own curriculum in a extremely tedious procedure. The teachers are teaching in the morning and the afternoon and writing curriculum in the late afternoon and getting it printed up in workbooks and testing it out on the children and then rewriting and testing and then finally getting a finished product. It's sort of a juggling act all while they're, you know, carrying on the regular school programs. Even though it's very difficult for them, I think it's going to be successful in the long run because our early indications are the student reaction to a coloring book called the Meshomas book have been very, very good. It's a combination creation story of the Anishinaabe and told by Meshomas, the grandfather, and the younger children also get to color in the book, so it's kind of neat. Yes?
Have you done any recording for this Bear's Den Bar we heard about?
Yeah, I think that brings up an interesting point. The American Indian Press Association always had as a goal regional news bureaus. We wanted an Upper Midwest Bureau and a Far West and a Southwest and East Coast, and we never had that. We always sort of had to run around and catch up with the stories after they happen. And our news packets go out weekly. Maybe I didn't explain that to you, and I should tell you about that. They're typed up on Mimeo, and then they're put through the machine, and perhaps 15 or 20 stories are sent out per week. We have a system where if you have Frank Foolscrow addressing the Senate, and you have the Bear's Den being burned down, the Foolscrow story is going to take precedent over the Bear's Den story. Say you have a murder at Stillwater, that's going to take precedent. So we do have some selection process over the story. And I think in that particular situation, we should have had coverage and didn't, simply because we didn't have a person up here representing the news service that could have gotten the story firsthand. We've had experience with getting stories over the phone, calling up and, you know, long distance and this and that. And often we find we don't get the right thing. So we've been very wary of covering regional stories, and for this reason we're most anxious to get our regional representatives going, because it's particularly true of American Indians. Their tribes are spread out all across the country, and we cannot make a decision to cover just one part of the country. And so we've had to decide to cover just national news as much as possible.
But, so you're not going to try to make an issue out of the hearings that are going to be going on now?
What hearings are this? On their license, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course.
There's quite a bit of injustice being done there, and it looked to me like it might be a good, story for a newspaper to really pick up on.
Yeah. Well, first of all, unfortunately, we're not producing at all, which is real bad. No money. And second of all, yes, we probably should cover it, and something that increases in intensity, and as this would affect several thousand people, probably the effort would have been made to get somebody on the story. As a matter of fact, we do have a person, Naomi Lyons, who had a communications project with high school students in the city of Minneapolis. Of course, the problem is not having any funds and not being able to pay anybody. So I think that a Midwest Indian newspaper is a viable concept. I think it can work. But there again, yeah.
In this connection, what kind of journalistic apprenticeship experience is powerful in people getting their training in Indian journalism?
Well, I think, first of all, they're trained as journalists. Secondly, there is a responsibility or a burden on them to learn the federal system. It's extremely difficult. There are people who graduate from law schools that don't know the federal system, but a journalist must know that. They must know how a bill becomes a law. And it sounds rather simple, but once you get to Washington, D.C., you find that it often isn't. And the system is different in the Senate than it is in the House. You must get to know the federal agency programs in terms of what they provide to Indians based on the unique trust relationship between Indians and the U.S. They must also get to know the 500 or 600 top personalities in the Indian world, I guess for lack of a better word, and be able to recognize them on site, in addition to major, congressmen and federal agency people, state people who are regularly concerned with Indian affairs. I think that's one of the hardest things that I had to learn, as a matter of fact, because I'm bad at remembering names. And I would say, well, there's, what's his name? So that's part of the training. And being able to sleep, 3 hours a night and enjoy it. Yes.
What kind of Midwest thing would you like to see? Would you prefer the approach that our society takes, or would you prefer to have pretty much an objective newspaper type publication in the modern country?
Well, I've not only been giving it some thought, but a number of people have talked about it, and particularly Naomi and some others who are journalists themselves. They'd like to see a tabloid size, regular paper, 35-pound newsprint, and perhaps published each week or every 2 weeks. And where it would make a difference is that it would have home delivery on the reservation. We have this rather exotic delivery scheme of sending the papers out on Greyhound buses and having people that deliver them door to door, because it's sort of a fundamental thing. I mean, you've got to get people to read the paper first. But yes, we would have the same philosophy as AIPA: balanced coverage, good news, a lot of it, and give the folks what they want too, because people have different tastes. Not everybody wants all legislation. They're going to want other things too. But sort of like that. If you don't have any more questions, well, let me know if you do. But if you don't, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Red Schoolhouse. And this is not really part of the Indian journalism talk that I had planned for tonight. Okay. The Red Schoolhouse started in 1972. The concept had been around previous to that as part of the philosophy of the American Indian movement to provide spiritually and culturally based education to their children, whom they knew were dropping out of the schools. Some of the students were still in the schools, but they had mentally dropped out, they'd spiritually dropped out. So Red Schoolhouse in Heart of the Earth in Minneapolis began, and there is now a federation of some seven schools: Denver Indian Survival School, Winnipeg Survival School, White Earth AIM Survival School, Soaring Eagle Academy in Green Bay, Red Schoolhouse and Heart of the Earth, and one other, the Milwaukee School in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Among the difficulties, the We Will Remember School in Rapid City. Among the difficulties that all of these schools have had is a continuing resistance on the part of the public school systems to recognize the value that these schools have had in the community. They're a little far down the road to be trial efforts. They've proven themselves to be viable institutions, and they've proven themselves to be providing a good, in terms of Indian values, education to their children. However, funding is difficult. Some of the schools are doing okay, some of them are doing not okay, some of them are in desperate situations. On February 28th, the Red Schoolhouse is initiating a walk for survival, which will be 15 miles in and through St. Paul, to raise money to support these survival schools, hopefully to get them the kind of money that they can't get anywhere else from foundations, money to repair the buildings, money to go into the student treasury for the cultural programs, sort of nuts and bolts money that they just desperately need at this point. So I believe Debbie has a number of printed sheets that she brought along with her tonight to pass out to people, which can give you some general information on the walk and something about the philosophy of the school. But I thought, since I had you as a captive audience in front of me, that I would say something about that. And if you can't be there, be there, in your minds, or support one of the kids. They'll be around with their pledge cards. And I think the only thing we're saying is that it's 25-cent minimum, right? 25 cents a mile? Oh, no minimum. No minimum, no cover. So send a kid on the walk, and, you know, we'll see what we can raise for the schools. Thank you very much. Yes. Pardon me? At the school? Yeah. Well, I just talked a little bit about, you know, why they're developing curriculum. The substance of it derives from the teachers all getting together and sort of evaluating the students. They did, there had been some outside testing done by the doctors Silberberg of St. Paul, and I believe those were psychological profiles. But in the academic areas, the teachers found that some of the students were doing very well in math, some of them not so well, and they felt that they needed math workbooks, but oriented to the Indian point of view, once again, introducing culture and spirituality all along the way. Reading books are extremely necessary. Those are being developed, as well as people who are constantly in contact with the children that need reading help. Writing, expository writing, literature, being able to handle poetry, being able to read, being able to tell the difference between an opinion and a fact, those kinds of things are also important. Survival skills, how to fill out an income tax form, how to get food stamps, what happens when you get arrested, those kind of things are also being taught. Many of the other skills that we would like to introduce are not being taught at the moment, but they're being planned for. So I would say that overall it's a balance of the basic academic requirements, which we know the children need, survival skills, which we know they will need for their life, and everything else that we can provide in the way of culturally based reinforcement, spiritual reinforcement.
Who pays the teacher's salary? Can you ask them?
I really can't answer that because I don't know. I know a number of people are volunteers, and many are near volunteers. Very, very minimum salaries. I know they have a project which is paid by Title IV of the Indian Education Act. And I think some salaries come out of that. And I think they have a probation and parole act, which project, which is funded through the state. And I think they have some people through that. But I really couldn't tell you for sure. They do have some donations too, but I'm not sure. I don't think they rely on that for salaries. So. I know that the two women that provide the hot lunches. We had a unfortunate situation. The school was participating in the hot lunch program, and the food was coming to the school spoiled, and so they had to get rid of that. And I know that two women came in and did it for nothing for quite some time. So when there is a need, somehow the answer comes through. Thank you.